start rolling out on these nets? Have you increased or decreased your economy? Well, I think most of you would say that you've increased your economy, but at the end of this class, when my feeling your optimism was messed full. We have with us today Andy Orr, who is the moderator of the Cyber Rights List and active in Computer Professionals for Social Responsibility. And since we've got people, and I see at least one of you bought his book, so you can make him sign it. And then one of the things they're going to talk about, since we're going to begin by talking to students about how databases have developed and how they are used to make you less autonomous. So in fact, watch what you do and violate your privacy. One of the proposed solutions for this is a platform for privacy preferences from MIT, which is a technological solution. WFRC, which just happens to be in Cambridge. And this is a technological solution to a policy question. And in that framework, Andy is going to speak on how that technology works and how it fails. And then, after about 10 minutes, I'm going to start put your name cards up, and once again, attempting to pronounce everyone's name in sequence, calling on you, and ask you to argue the point and tell me if you have become more or less autonomous of your access to the internet and how you might argue that point. That was very autonomous.
You go online, but you realize that you're giving them a credit card, you're giving them an address, and You're telling them that this is a new place you bought, because if you buy a lot of furniture, they know that you've just moved. So if you're not sure that they're going to treat your data with confidence. Currently, what you have to do is look through the site, maybe find this tiny little thing that says privacy policy. When you click on it, you see a privacy policy that looks so scary that you swear you'll never use your computer for anything more serious than GoldenCoop. But supposing you do go through with this, you don't really know what they're doing with the data, even if they've told you. If you feel they've done something fraudulent with it, you can go to the FTC. This is Simpson's talk, so don't go to that. Now, what P3P does, P3P means you don't have to look for a privacy policy or even think about it. P3P will let your computer ask the server what it's going to do with your data, and in very broad terms, the server tells you. And then it may reject the server entirely. You may end up not buying the furniture because it doesn't do what you want. Or if they give you a little dialog box saying this policy is less strict than you want. Perhaps it will say, we will share your data with other organizations whose goods and services may interest you. That's a very typical privacy policy thing. And you'll say, no way. And if the browser and the server are sophisticated enough, you can say no, and the server will come back and say, we still want your business. So we will not share your data with any other organization. And in fact, we will discard it after the current transaction is finished. And furthermore, the Better Business Bureau audits our site. I didn't just pick that out of the hat. The Better Business Bureau does have a service which audits websites, along with Trustee, another service you may have heard of. So those three things I mentioned are all actual fields in the P3P protocol. That's why I happen to mention those things. They'll use the data just within their own organization. They'll discard it after the current transaction, and they are audited by the Better Business Bureau. Now we get to the next CPSR no-no, which is it's actually a whole internet no-no, which is trusting who's on the other side of the protocol. You never trust anything that comes to your computer except what you can actually see. You may have heard, well, let's say you have a Microsoft Office product running and you get a little packet seeing whether you can accept a request on that service, and you say yes, and the next thing you know, your computer is running a program that's sending 5 megabits of data per second to Yahoo. This is what happened last week with those overwhelmed websites. So you never trust who's on the other side. And
on that computer professionals and social responsibility, no, no, P3P. Look this up. This is how our browser started up. This site started to connect to the internet. It said, hey, look, it's fast, easy, fun, and free. So, do you think that it's fast? You know, is it necessarily free? And how would P3P change consumers' interaction?
Well, it would just have a privacy policy on there, and then if it asks you, well, is this asking you for much information? This is perhaps not full enough, because it doesn't ask you for your address. Right? It asks you maybe it asks you for your email address. That's about as far as it would go. But if something was to ask you to sign up for a service, and please give us your address and give us your place of business and what is your what is your job title, all those things are fields, not exactly in the P3P protocol, but another protocol that goes along with it, where they define all the things that a server can ask you and all the things that you give it back.
So anything I would give here. Something that P3P would ask about. And then they would turn around. Let's see. Oh, I have options.
Yeah.
So how would this be different from?
These things haven't been implemented yet. But I would assume that they tell you where they would store this. They'd say, we will just store this and we will not share it with anybody. Or you got the answer?
We ask some questions.
Okay. So we're running this program here called Netscape Navigator. And this program was written by a corporation called Netscape. The original idea of Netscape was to make money by commercializing the internet. Does everybody know this? Does anybody not know this? So many people don't know this. So the idea of Netscape was the internet was sort of this fairly academic place. And people were told it's not safe for commercial activity because there's no way to protect information. And so Netscape's theory was they would create a way for sending cryptographically protected information across the internet from anybody to anybody, and that that would then give them a platform from which they could commercialize. And they would somehow make money. The idea was they would give away these browsers, and they would sell servers. And it would use a proprietary protocol that they owned called SSL. Now, that didn't fly very well. So then they said, well, we're going to make SSL a standard and allow anybody to use it. Now, over time, Netscape's business strategy changed. They realized they were making a lot of money selling browsers, even though you could download it for free. They were selling some books, there was a commercial version, it was even better. And they realized they weren't making as much money selling servers as they had hoped. So then they tried to get into the browser selling model. But they didn't make enough money to cover their costs. So what they started doing was they realized that there were features in the browser that could generate far more money for them than the browser software itself ever could. And that was the, where are the links?
Oh, you're
hidden them. Which is a bad thing.
The built-in bookmark.
Yeah, the built-in bookmark.
Well, the bookmarks is the third thing.
They realized that they could pre-distribute Netscape with places on the internet to go. And they could charge people money for being included in the distribution. And if we actually had it here, well, we don't. Originally, there were a whole bunch of buttons along this. No, there was like a search button, which would take you to the Netscape search site. And they realized they could put an ad here on the site and charge money to have, basically, so that your ads, so that their ads would be displayed to Netscape users. And here's an ad. And that they had paid approximately 3 cents to display that ad to this class of the company Netmarket. Some of the ads, if you click on them, they make more money. Advertising was also useful in another way. It turned out that a lot of people are internet illiterates, and when the program started up, it took you to this location. And they never ever changed their home page. It took you to the Netscape homepage. And they quickly realized that if there were all these people going to the Netscape homepage all the time, that they could put ads on that page. And they could create what came to be known as a portal, where lots of information would be displayed every time you clicked in. And sometimes somebody would be paying to display that information to you. Now, in the evolution of these things, this actually turned out to be Netscape's killer business strategy. And it turned out that deploying all those browsers and deploying the server technology simply so it would be a platform to display ads was a far more winning concept than the idea of just trying to make money off selling software. Now, it's really not that strange an idea because AOL had done exactly the same thing about the same period of time. AOL used to make money by having people dial up, and they realized that they could show ads to people. And they realized that they were making more money off the ads than off the connect time. And so around the time that all this happened, AOL said, we're not going to charge people by the hour anymore. We're just going to let people stay on as long as they want, because their real source of revenue was the ads. Now,
Netscape was
the
first company to
do you think if they're collecting your information? Oh, I'm going to get to that. Now, something about advertising on the internet. Has anybody here ever advertised on the internet? I have. If you want to advertise on the internet, you can buy all kinds of ads. The cheapest, dirt cheap ads are like $3 to $6 per 1,000 impressions. It's called 3 to 6 CPM, because M means 1,000. And they go anywhere. But if you want selectivity, it costs one. If you want to show your ad to simply like women, then you have to find a site that like displays things to women, like women.com or iVillage. Or if you want to have, go after like webheads, geeks, you could advertise on Wired. But everybody's moved to AOL. Or everybody's moved to Netscape Center, which is actually now owned by AOL. And how could they make these ads pay more? Well, by targeting the ad. You can raise the amount of money that you can charge for that, you being AOL, if you know who it's going to be displayed to. If I know that it's going to be displayed to only women, 25 to 35, I can raise my CPM from like $3 to $6 to like $15 to $30. And if I know that it's only going to be displayed to women who might have an income over $80,000, I might be able to get 50 CPM for that ad. Really good money, much better money. For the same cost of displaying the ad, all you have to do is know where it's going. Now, the way that this was originally implemented was with a pervasive tracking system called cookies. Everybody here know what cookies are? Anybody not know what they are? Now, the interesting thing about cookies is that the original idea of cookies was not to be this tracking system to tell people whether you're a man or a woman or rich or poor. The original idea of cookies was to protect people's privacy. The original idea of cookies was that we would store personal information on the person's computer, and then when they came to our website, they would display it, present their personal information to us. We would do our personalization things, and we would send it back. Example, say you have your zip code, enter your city, state, and zip for weather, right? Actually, I prefer the MSN homepage. So we'll go to MSN.com. And the way this homepage is set up is you can tell it where you want to see news or sports. You can tell it where you are, and it will customize for you. And the way Microsoft did that was they stored your zip code and they stored whether you want news or sports in the cookie. And that way they don't have to build this big database to track everybody on the internet. Marketers realized, oh, we can use these cookies as a big database to track everybody on the internet. And instead of asking you to keep the personal information on your computer, we'll store an identifier number and we'll use that to key into our database. And then if you have a register somewhere or providing, you're going to pull one up. If you have a register on a website, or if you ever provide your name or provide an age or do something somewhere that they can key into that personal information, they can then track you consistently. They just gotta pull up the cookies file. Now, it turns out that Netscape and Windows do, Netscape and Internet Explorer do cookies in different ways. So complicating this whole thing has been this battle of the browser. But here's some cookies. And Pathfinder.com was recording things, and DoubleClick.net was recording things. The interesting thing about I don't know what sextracker.com is. I'm actually not going to go to that page because I don't know what it is. But if you go back down here, this is a more interesting section of the cookie file. This is about their story on your machine. This is where it came from. So, cookies were a disaster. And the reason cookies have been a disaster is because they evolved in an organic fashion, and they were being pushed. The companies that were making the browsers were the same companies that were beginning to make staggering amounts of money off of internet advertising. AOL, Netscape, and Microsoft. The original cookie control was that, like, you should have the ability to say yes to cookies or say no to cookies. And then if you wanted to say no, we'll alert you every time somebody's sending a cookie at you. There are ways you could design this system to be more privacy positive, which is what Andy was talking about with P3P.
Can I interrupt your interruption for just a second? Okay, I'll give you the floor back again, but this is a little aphorism I'd like to give you. This leads into a principle I'd like to suggest. A lot of people say, oh, technology can hurt our privacy. Technology can do these things to us. Bad things can happen from technology. I think it's really the people who are in control, whether financially or in political power, they are the ones that can help or hurt us. And they will use whatever technology is available. Cookies originally were very innocuous, but someone found a way to get around them because the money got so big, the stakes got so high, it was worthwhile finding a way to maybe pervert this. You don't mind if it like that to be something. So you can bend the technology, but just think, if something is important enough, people with enough money and enough power will find a way to use whatever technology is there to get what they want. I'll turn the floor back to you.
Well, that's good. Let's go get that. So the interesting thing about the cookie technology is the way it was created was to assist the goals of marketers. The cookie control technology. They didn't consciously decide to make it very difficult to disable cookies, but they didn't go out of their way to make it easy. Maybe to do it on a site-by-site basis. Maybe so that Amazon, which was using cookies to implement shopping carts, you could use cookies on Amazon's website, but maybe not on Novoclip, which is the pervasive advertising network. Now, P3P was a desire to overcome many of these problems. In the original version of P3P, I said, well, you know, let's think about the transfer of this hidden information, and if privacy issues are important to people, this isn't really privacy, this is really data protection. People will accept data, and then they have certain rights and responsibilities, and these so-called privacy policies are really data integrity policies and data custodian policies. They define what people should, what people say they will and will not do with data. The idea of P3P was to say, well, let's let a thousand flowers bloom. Let's let every site come up with their own privacy policy. We've already done that. But let's have an automated way that your browser and the web server can decide if your privacy preferences are compatible with the web server's privacy policy. Now, interestingly, the main reason that P3P was created was because these web companies were terrified by the idea of government regulation. They really wanted to stave off any government regulation that might protect or create responsibilities for those for personal information. So the idea was, well, we'll create this voluntary system, this P3P technology, and then the consumers can just choose themselves how they want to protect their privacy. Now, what is this privacy stuff anyway? Using where you go to these websites and they'll have privacy policy. What's a privacy policy? What's the MSN privacy policy? Because it actually is a good one. Microsoft has actually gotten it right. The idea was there's a tremendous amount of data moving around. And when you go to a website, you are conveying information. Website, you're involved in the exchange. At the very least, you have these cookies that are being presented. But you're presenting other information as well. You're presenting, for instance, the IP address that you're coming from. You're presenting the speed of your connection by how fast you can put download or upload pages. So people can determine whether you're coming from a cable modem or a DSL link or a dial-up, or whether it's just a bad day for the internet. The HTTP specification actually calls for you to present your username and your email address as part of every request to the remote web server, but that hasn't been implemented. There are other things that you present as well. Of course, anytime you fill out a form, you present information still. So, a lot of websites said, well, you know, we'd like to get a lot of information from the users, but we'd like to make them feel good about giving us information. And some websites are actually concerned about the free flow of information. So websites start creating these privacy policies. Esther Dyson started an organization called eTrust, which was later renamed to eTrustee, and for trademark reasons. And the idea of trustee would be they would be in a position to audit the privacy policies of websites. Now originally, they had three model privacy policies. And one was called like one-to-one, where they would do direct marketing to you based on all the information that you provided. And another was like an anonymous privacy policy, where they wouldn't collect personal information. And another was one where they would collect the information and release it to third parties. And they all hid this behind trustee labels. And the problem with these approaches was that they were too confining for the organizations that were creating privacy policies. So trustee basically gave up on that approach and came up with a new approach. It says people create text, and trustee will go in to see if their policies comply with the text if anybody complains. And that's basically the current trustee model. Now, I'd like to see if Andy or Jim wants to say anything, but then I want to take a little backspace to the 1960s about how we got to this problem and how we came up with the sort of principles that MSN or other websites are putting up.
I'm willing to see whether you peter out, because I have other things to say, but I think you have better things.
Well, I don't know if they're better, but I want to sort of put it into a context. talking about the fair information principle. And you see, there's something that's been happening on the internet today, in the 28 minutes I left. You probably want to ask some questions too. They both did questions. If you want to interrupt me at any time. What's happening is that there's this whole generation of people designing software and services who have absolutely no clue how to handle personal information. Because in this country, we don't teach that. In this country, we sort of have a roll-your-own approach. And so over the past year, we've seen a number of different kinds of privacy fiascos that have happened because we largely have no clue about the policy behind personal information. For example, the server wants to send us a cookie. Within the past year, there was this company called Real Networks, or Real.com, and they were releasing a program called the Real Jukebox. And it allowed you to listen to MP3s on the web and to streaming audio. But one of the things that it did was it transmitted a list of everything that you listened to back to Real.com for monitoring. And it transmitted it with a unique number that was assigned to you when you installed the program. And one of the things when you install this program is you have to give them an email address. They don't have to give them your real email address, but people don't like to lie. It's very difficult for people to be told, you know, to constantly be lying on the internet. They like to tell the truth. It's something of human nature. We're taught to do that. It's good public policy. And it was a major embarrassment for the company when it was discovered that they were tracking everyone that everybody was listening to. Another privacy fiasco was DoubleClick. DoubleClick has been assembling this pervasive list of basically every advertisement that we see on the internet. And they have another organization that they just bought that is a catalog merchant. And they now say that even though for the past 4 or 5 years they've been telling people that these privacy, that these profiles that they have of everybody is anonymous, they're now going to link them up with names. So they actually have a list of every website that you've gone to, and a list of every ad that you've seen, and a list of which ads you clicked on, which is very, very interesting information, because it might tell you, like, are people making authorized or unauthorized use of their computers? Some people use computers at work, but they're not allowed to go to certain kinds of sites. Now, there's nothing wrong with tracking that information, but there may be something wrong from a public policy point of view of collecting information under one guise, under one set of principles, and then changing the principles and retroactively going back and re-harvesting all that data. Well, there is something wrong with it. Back in the 1960s, we had tremendous problems with privacy in this country, but with data protection in this country. There were large organizations, credit databases, who were recording basically gossip databases, lists of things that people had done bad, so that you could then deny these people jobs and employment credit. And one of them was like for a guy who had been in the military. It was like, Don used to shoot cattle who were grazing on the reservation, and therefore he shouldn't be given credit, or Jane dresses sloppily, or Sid cheats on his wife. And this was actually done. This was the subject of numerous congressional hearings. Congress had 5 actual committees, emergency committees that were set up to explore the invasion of privacy caused by computers. And the problem wasn't that people were gossiping about each other, they had been doing that for centuries. The problem is that these gossips were being tabulated, indexed, organized, put into a database, and made available to any business who wanted to buy them. And frequently, when these gossip reports were delivered to the business, they were delivered under a license that prohibited the business from revealing the contents of the report to the individual on whom the report was collected. And also prohibited them from telling the individual that the database even existed. Congress passed the Fair Credit Reporting Act, which created the regime under which you're now living. And the regime, you need to be a U.S. citizen, or if you have credit from a U.S. company. And that says basic things like you have a legal right to see your credit report. And if there's wrong information in that credit report, they have an obligation to correct it.
And also prohibited the gathering of certain
evidence. Well, actually did, but what was the prohibited gathering?
There was a name for the gossip
reports. Oh, no, it allows investigative reports to be gathered, but they have to. There's a much higher level of standards that they have to follow, and it's so difficult that Equifax and TransUnion decides just not to do investigative reports.
But they can't put them in.
Right. Every report, every piece of information in an investigative report has to be substantiated, and they have to actually know the source of that information. In 1974, Elliot Richardson, who was the Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, put out a report on that codified a number of these ideas into what was called the Code of Fair Information Practices. And it had the basic ideas: no secret database, if there's wrong information, you're allowed to correct it. You would like to see your report. Information collected for one purpose can't be used for another purpose. And companies had to take a lot of responsibility when they create these databanks of personal information. You create the database, creates responsibilities that you have. They became information custodians. We didn't do anything with that code of fair information practices in the United States because Watergate was happening and we were a little preoccupied as a country. And Elliot Richardson resigned. We had this whole thing out of a guy named Archibald Cox, who was told to fire. It gets on and on. But we then didn't do anything in the late 70s because we had this president named Jimmy Carter who was a little preoccupied with the economy and with hostages in Iran. And in the 80s, we didn't do anything with the code of fair information practices. Because we had this president named Reagan. He couldn't remember anything. Not to make fun of the president's current medical condition, he couldn't remember anything then either. And his aides didn't think that privacy protection was an important issue. Now, anybody here from Europe? Or Canada? The European countries did do something. They took up our code of fair information practices and they made it into federal or state law in this country. But not here. So much of what's happening on the internet today is basically a reaction to the threat that some sort of privacy legislation might be passed. And so we're searching for all of these technical solutions to avoid any kind of regulation that might protect people's rights. This is really interesting because this is coming from companies that are strongly in favor of federal legislation when it's to protect the rights of companies. When it has to do with copyright protection or us asserting patent rights or preventing dumping from foreign countries in the U.S. or fighting Microsoft, these companies are all for federal protection and federal legislation. But when it comes to something that has to do with consumers, they're all saying, let's do this on a voluntary basis. And there's this guy named Jason Kellett, and he runs Junk Busters. You call it junkbusters.com? Junk Busters is this great website. It sort of shows the world we're in now. He's all devoted to stopping junk mail and telemarketing. And all of these organizations that like to call you at 6 p.m. and flood you with credit card requests have created voluntary systems that you can opt out of their databases so that they won't pester you anymore. And one of the interesting things about the Junk Busters website is that they will automate the process of sending letters to all these companies saying, please, company, take me out of your database. They really will do it. This is great. There's a thing you can go out, go through, and fill in all your personal information. It will display pages. Yeah, click on Junk Mail. And it will display pages, and then it will print out the numbers, and then mail them to you. And Jason's a good guy. But it does show the insanity that you have to send out 30 or 40 pieces of mail saying, please don't send me mail, when in fact what should really be happening is that these companies should be asking me permission to send you mail, which should only be coming to you if you've already expressed the willingness to get this stuff. I'm in favor of, right. So what I'm in favor of is a pervasive federal legislation inside the United States. I want to see the creation of a federal privacy watchdog agency, maybe a federal information protection office. They would be the people at the table arguing for protection of consumer rights. And then I want to see this idea of the fair information practices put into U.S. law so that we can go into their database and find out what the contents of all those cookies means. Because right now, there's just a bunch of numbers. They have no legal responsibility to tell us what this could be. That's where I'm heading with this.
I think I'll skip the rest of PPP, and unless people are really wild up and really want to hear about it, but I will say three very general things. Yeah, overstep the bounds I set for myself. The first thing that comes to mind is that information is good. And when you have more privacy, you take away something that society can really use. I think, for instance, of finding a cure for cancer. Obviously, the only great way to find a cure for cancer probably is to just track everybody's habits, everybody's genes, everybody's medical histories and your lifestyles, and then see who gets cancer. In fact, Iceland is doing something similar to this. But we aren't holding on to our medical data. We're very scared of having it shared. So if you want privacy, you have to be willing to give up something. And people in the privacy field sometimes sort of apologetic about that, or they feel like they're fighting a no-go action. But they just have to be open about it. We're giving up something good that society can do for the sake of privacy. Another point is that privacy is sometimes just, it just masks a fear of abuse of power. And this is something, actually almost everything you've said is in Database Nation and Simpson's book, but this was touched on. People may be afraid of giving up data in general, like if you drank a lot on Saturday night, you may be embarrassed to have your colleagues know about it. But most things that make you afraid of losing privacy are things where people will unfairly use their power against you. That you won't get a promotion because your boss knows what websites you've seen, or you won't get life insurance because of your genes or something. So privacy abuses are like other power abuses. It's just like there's a tycoon in Vancouver or Tokyo who can decide to burn millions of acres of Indonesian rainforest. There are lots of ways that power are abused in this society. And if we could reduce some of those abuses, well, privacy would still be important, but it would definitely impact privacy.
But given that all these abuses and all these types of power exist, the privacy of information about who, and other people are much better at collecting privacy
How much information about you? How much information do you have about double-click? Probably the following one. Okay, but the interesting thing is Andy's assertion that information is good, but asserting privacy rights for giving up other rights, that's actually something that I would disagree with. That's a pervasive form of thinking in the U.S., which I call the trend story. The trend story is that
you know, information, advanced technologies will make new features possible, but it's also going to permit violations of privacy. Privacy activists are upset, but it's the price we pay for living in a modern society. And I think it represents really a failure of the part of public policy thinking. So the new kind of thinking that I'm trying to support is basically the old kind of thinking, which is fair information practices, which is saying, there's, you know, if you want to create a pervasive tracking network, fine. If you want to create a system that tracks the medical records of everybody in the United States, fine. If you want to use webcams in downtown just to do face recognition on everybody who walks through and search against a list of 1,000 people who are currently, you know, escaped or are under arrest but haven't shown up for their report, fine. But what we need to do is we need to have discussions on these issues as a society. We need to know what information is being collected. We need to have a right to see the data banks. We have a right to know that the information that's collected for one purpose isn't going to be used for another purpose. And I think that only if we assure those rights are we actually going to be able to benefit or to enjoy the benefits of the advanced technology. Because right now, I'd love to see you know, very large longitudinal studies looking at what everybody eats and comparing it against their medical records. Because I would like to know when I get a new drug prescribed, of the 10,000 people who are of my age and have my diet and have my similar medical condition, when they're given this drug, what happened to them? Did they go into shock? Did another drug work better? And we actually have sufficient information gathering and processing capabilities that we can do that. But we don't have the public policy structures in place to let us do that.
We do have medical databases. I mean, that's an important thing to acknowledge, that there is a medical clearing house. You don't have a right to see your medical record. Your doctor may be able to see your medical record if he or she requests it. Your insurance company has a right to see your medical record. And this is, again, the financial records. The point of financial records is it's the financial records all over again. That there is information in there that is completely, I mean, it's random, wrong information. For example, you know, I'm actually, shockingly enough, as you suspected, professors are, a really boring person. I like to do things like bake. But on my medical record, it could say that my hobbies are
skydiving,
bungee jumping.
Actually, there are multiple medical databases. You're talking about the Medical Information Bureau, which is actually a really boring database because it just has these notations about what dangerous hobbies you engage in and what things you've been treated for. And they actually will give you a right to see it because they've admitted that they're
researchers in Utah don't necessarily have it. Let's get, see if we can get this.
Well, is there anybody in this room after us? You know, like, we can take 5 questions, and people can leave, and then we'll lose this committee, and then everybody has a really serious discussion.
Yeah, but we're very into structure. This is a school policy. We're just structuring, you know?
All the good legislation gets passed after midnight. Anyway, any questions?
Our
fair information practice is enforceable. Does anybody comes from a country that has some forms of job?
Emma, have you ever gotten a credit card solicitation in the mail in Canada?
But if you had applied to a Canadian bank, they would be able to access your credit, right? Because they know how to deal within the context of the law.
Just this morning, I called my boss and said that he made solicitation for credit cards. And then I said, yes, please, I got the credit cards pulled up for credit rating here, and then I took the mail, and then I gave him all the information for writing. Think exactly how to access my credit rating in Canada and measure it. But I think that I got the credit cards this week in Canada before.
Yeah, well, you probably did, but you probably got less fewer of them. The interesting thing is, you know, are these things enforceable? Well, is legislation that you shouldn't be your spouse enforceable? It happens inside a living room. What if you have the shades down? How will anybody know that you are beating your spouse? Because it leaves marks, telltale marks. And privacy violations or data protection violations leave telltale marks. If they don't, then they don't really matter if they have a conviction. So yeah, I think this sort of legislation is enforceable. I also think it's constitutional, which is probably a better question. You know, there are First Amendment issues, right? But we can regulate on the basis of commerce clause. And argue that
we have an undertaking.
Then I'm a lawyer. It's public policy.
So if it doesn't work, you know, with technology, which is kind of what Andy was addressing. John?
What was the third point that was going to say about the difficulty with privacy or the problems of privacy?
Well, I had a few of them. I was going to say one more thing about the European Union. They have had a good 20 to 30 years of having laws in place, and they must have a lot of case law, and there must have been a lot of studies done on how to do this right. I haven't seen many of them, which is very strange because I've been researching this. I know that someone named Deborah Hurley, who's had a connection with Harvard, I don't know if she still does, and she worked with the European Union, and she's also worked with American agencies. It would be great for someone to take on as a research project what has worked in Europe and what can be done here. When I see the initiatives, if you look in the papers, you see all the time there are congresspeople trying new initiatives. There was just an article on Friday in the Globe about Ed Markey. But a lot of these things are sort of, it seems like they're just taking baby steps. And it's rather like watching fifth graders in a cooking class. It's very exciting. There's a lot of experimentation going on. You wouldn't actually want to use anything they come up with, though.
Yeah, there actually is a very good book that David Flaherty wrote comparing privacy regulation in 8 or 9 countries. It's in my bibliography. Yeah. So by all means, yeah, these studies have been done. There's not so much case law, you might imagine, because you know, aside from England and the United States, case law is less important. It's not based on English common law, but there certainly has been a lot of experience dealing with privacy.
I guess I wonder, can you talk about the nonprofit sector and what role it might be able to play in this, like the trustee organization, and what are the drawbacks to that sector playing this monitoring role versus government?
Yeah.
Or the advantage.
Right.
Well, so when the Melissa virus came out, the macrovirus, and it was really just a Simpsons joke, you know, but it was a pervasive Simpsons joke, and it tended to choke people's mailers. So when they just, when this Mac, when this virus came out, the Microsoft said, oh, well, you know, there, that unique identifier that we said was just in there for technical reasons. Yeah, it turns out we actually save it correlated to your registration information. Oh, didn't we mention that? And I would like to note that if you look at Trust and Microsoft's privacy policy, it turns out that it's still trustee approved. And if you look
that's
at
trustee. That's very interesting. It turns out the trustee contract with Microsoft only covers the website. It doesn't cover the software. It turns out that until 6 weeks ago, there was no person inside Microsoft charged with assuring compliance with privacy policies in the software. 6 weeks ago, they created a position for dealing with information data protection issues. Now, the guy they had was a real winner, and he's going to, he has a charter now to review all the software.
And who's the biggest funder?
A number of companies have donated $100,000, of which Microsoft is one of them. But Trustee didn't have a legal link to stand on in going after Microsoft, because it has a contract, and under the terms of the contract, it only covered the website. It didn't cover the software. This was exactly the same problem with Real Networks. We said, we don't track you on our website, but their software did track you. The problem with enforcement by private contract is twofold. First, it's voluntary. It doesn't do a thing for bad players who simply don't want to sign up. And those bad players can be very large. It also tends not to work when people change their minds, because all these voluntary privacy policies are subject to change at any time without warning. Another problem is it creates an unfair playing field, because the companies that do want to protect privacy are competing against the ones that don't want to protect privacy but claim that they do. It's very difficult in an environment like that to find out who are the good players and who are the bad players. Another problem with voluntary enforcement is that the enforcement organizations, as Gene was trying to get at, they aren't going to go and fight the hand that feeds them. Federal government's going to entertain legislation against Microsoft, and some companies might. But for the most part, these voluntary organizations like Trustee don't want to create a state. Trustee doesn't want to create a state because then nobody else is going to join Trustee. I've spoken with the director of the organization. He thinks they can do more good back doors, you know, behind the shades, than by taking action against the Trustee members. Because if they do that, if they show themselves to be really combative, they'll all quit. And then the organization will die.
But if they don't show themselves,
the organization doesn't mean much. We don't take this approach for dealing with the environment.
Sorry, I just wanted to address the issue of Trustee. I've actually dealt with them before, and they don't particularly, you were laying the blame on Microsoft, sort of with respect to the privacy issues involved with Outlook. And Trustee actually doesn't seem to take a particularly strong interest, really, or their approval process is very simplistic in terms of they don't ask the right questions. They're a little behind the times. It's hard to find people at Trustee who actually care about kind of broadening the scope of what their compliance is about. And I think with respect to what Professor Kemp just brought up, if they don't make a big stink about issues, then they kind of lose credibility with the public. And I don't see how they're going to...
So you're saying don't ask, don't tell, just doesn't work anymore.
Right, basically, yes.
I have a feeling that PPP won't really go very far because people are seeing what Trustee is doing and failing to do, and they're beginning to see that these private solutions aren't working. So there will hopefully be a groundswell.
I look at this. If I can take your private solutions to trust the individuals that you speak with me, say they don't trust these companies. And for them, Trustee doesn't look that much like the Real Network. It's another.com.
There are other issues with private enforcement. Private enforcement means either you take someone to court yourself, and then that's a big thing to do, and then the court asks you, well, how were you harmed? And if you say, well, I got some junk mail, they'll say, okay, we'll give you 5 cents in compensation or something. I suppose Mr. Zittrain could explain better how contract law differs from the privacy laws in the European Union, perhaps. But you could also go to the FTC and ask them to enforce the law. I've heard FTC Assistant Commissioner said he will enforce it they will enforce violations of the contract, but other people said, no, they're not dirty. So what the vigilant has said.
Well, what about the concept of consent? I mean, you went to junk busters, and you can go to junk busters, and you can say, I don't want to have a web browser that has banner ads. You can get web browsers that will strip banner ads. You don't have to click from double click sends you that email. And, you know, double click sends you an email, and then you click on it, the point is, then it looks at your cookie because it brings up the browser, and it can connect the email to the cookie, and then it connects that to the database on catalog. So what about consent?
We have two kinds of issues about privacy. One is that, like, that we will inform telecom companies about our best email and something. Another thing is that the companies can track what we are doing, what's our data. I just got a report from the EC.com, and this happened in February, last week, February. And a subsidiary of Meta.com, they just download and install software with the Netscape application or the Internet Explorer. This software can track the Internet users, which web pages they are going. And actually, there should be something more about this. They can track everything in your computer, in your PCs. This is technically possible. And
you can also technically opt out, right? So
yeah.
There is no choice. You can go and.
So this company was invested by the Federal Trade Commission, and there are two cases, two issues about this. And Amina.com right now, they say, this is, it's business, not us, but this company is, Access is the subsidiary of Amina.com. The software can secretly intercept personal data and send that information to 30 parties, including Amina.com's parent company.
Although
secretly intercepting personal data means that you have cookies off.
Who
accepts cookies in their browser?
No,
it could
be
in a database.
No,
too.
I don't mean
it's
that.
It could mean that
it's possible that we have consented.
No, it could mean much more. It could mean that it's reading through your email and doing keyword analysis for product names.
Yeah, but hey, you sign a license when you downloaded it, Ron.
The thing is, there are a lot of websites that you cannot use if you don't have cookies on. Or, you know, you cannot use if you don't have certain technology, like JavaScript, if you don't have it, you know, enabled, or, you know, certain things that can affect what you're doing or can track your usage.
That's why I'm arguing for fair information practices, rather than arguing for technical controls. You see, there are good cookies, like the ones that store which zip code you're in, and there are bad cookies, which have an identifier number in the database. There's no real technical way that you can screen them out or make decisions between the two of them. That's why the whole idea of voluntary privacy controls is hooey. It just doesn't make sense because people aren't technically sophisticated enough to make the decisions that the software vendors claim they're going to be making in the future.
Do you happen to know whether, in fact, in Europe or in Canada, they're able to make that distinction in the cookie, reading the cookie?
That's interesting. We see they only use our software. And for the most part, they go to US-based websites. And there's supposed to be this European data directive that would say that the European laws for European citizens would apply when they were going to the US websites. And there was a date set. And on that day, the wires were going to be cut if the U.S. companies were not in the conformance. Does anybody know what that date was? The Europeans, you know, they're really good for things that happen within their countries that they understand. But for the most part, they've been caught unawares by the advanced technology. First of all, by the international pervasiveness. They're also doing a pretty lousy job of surveillance. In England, where they have privacy legislation, they also have 300,000 surveillance cameras that are making videotape records of everybody's coming and going. But the UK Data Protection Registrar has ruled or hasn't ruled and that those things are not under his purview right now. It shouldn't be.
I think there's always a trade-off between freedom and protection of your privacy. For example, if I'm really hypocritical about some websites, I have turned off the cookies, I can even turn on a port monitor and ensure all the information flow will be monitored by myself without my consent. My computer will not send out any information, but perhaps after some time I will get bored myself because I won't get instantaneous access to those information on the internet. Not spend 1 hour looking at those security information. So I think there's always a trade-off that you have to judge whether you want instantaneous access to the information available from the internet and enjoy that freedom or have too much concern about your privacy.
I'd like to rephrase what you said and put it in terms of your activities. It's as if you're saying, well, you know, here we are in the 1950s, and I'd like to be in a position where I can go out and buy any product I want, whether it's destroying the environment or not. I don't want to be in a position, I want to be in a position where I can buy the potassium cyanide in the store and have the instant gratification of killing all the fish in my fish tank, even if when I pour it down in the sink, it's going to do other damage. Now, what you're basically creating a false dilemma. You're saying that any privacy protection that we create is going to have to reduce the amount of ease of use and reduce convenience. And that's a very 1980s argument. That's the trend story.
Well, it will reduce convenience. Well, it will reduce the convenience of the programmers and the scientists. Let's not pretend that it doesn't have a cost. But it's not, what you're saying is the only option I have is to completely monitor it myself, right? Or if you have privacy, there are other options, and Simpson was arguing that having governmental monitoring means your website for this is going to be inconvenient, but you wouldn't be monitoring.
But you could have, for instance, a base level of privacy assured by legislative enactment. You could have regulatory regimes. You could have three choices of privacy, and they could very clearly indicate which of the three policy-based regimes they were going with, and then you can make a very simple decision. It could be that you say, I want the cookies that make the website easier to use, but I don't want the cookies that allow you to track them. You don't have that option right now. You only have the false dilemmas because we are in a completely voluntary regime. So your only choice is self-protection. It's as if we were in an environmental regime, and before when I got the stuff, I would have to read the ingredients to see if there was anything here that's poisonous. We have a pure Food and Drug Act, which assures that nothing in here is poisonous. I won't die by drinking this, by law. We don't have that privacy.
I'm just curious about an issue that I haven't heard you bring up, which is the distinction between opting out and opting in with respect to different kinds of personal information. I'm just curious what you think about, you know, policies that companies adopt or versus and policies that organizations like trustee or governmental law would enforce with respect to the differences between what types of information are things that people should have to opt in to share with others versus what types of things that people should be able to opt out from having shared in certain ways with other groups.
Well, that's the difference between what Simpson is basically advocating and what exists now. If you go to Junkbusters, you can come up with your own
declaration.
Very simple. And send it out. You can opt out now. You can get a browser that strips cookies. You can cut off and then strip banner ads. You can cut off all your cookies. You can opt out now. So I think the question would be that adequate. Now in the back row, on the second day, somebody was arguing that we don't need any regulation, that the people are responsible for understanding the technology.
Well, because most people don't understand the technologies is the problem, I think.
So what do you think?
We haven't taken that approach in environmental protection. We haven't taken that approach in saying you can have clean air if you buy air filters. James Watt in the Reagan administration said that we had no reason to worry about the destruction of the ozone layer. People would just have to wear sunscreen. And people would wear like UV resistant lenses in their glasses. And these are UV resistant, so I'm protecting myself because regulation failed for a while. On the other hand, we believe that there should certainly be minimal standards, different present a livable environment, and I believe that a livable information environment is equally part of that. And yes, it is people's responsibility to understand the world that they're living in. I just don't think we have that responsibility. But, you know, we like to think that we have informed citizens.
Just to help focus things a little bit, maybe first Andy and then Simpson could tell us, for a worst but still plausible privacy nightmare on the internet. Does it have to do with junk mail? Does it have to do with me getting unsolicited things in my mailbox that I'm likely to like because the company has gathered enough data to know that I prefer fast cars to golf clubs? What's your nightmare, Andy?
My nightmare would go beyond the internet, because the internet is just a screen that I see on my computer. But real life, the internet does interact with real life. That's why we have policy. So if I send email that my boss doesn't like and he reads my email and fires me, that's a nightmare. Or if somebody finds out that I have a certain disease because I send email to my doctor and my life insurance is canceled or something, that would be the nightmare. If you just stay on the internet, it would be hard to find.
Okay, we should be keeping lists here. And those of you in the audience who want to play along, we can keep your lists as well.
Database Nation has a lot of good lists.
Yeah. So I guess the other thing is, well, you wanted me to confine it to the internet because I was going to say, well, I've been listening a whole lot more than the internet. But let's just stick on the internet. It's important when we talk about the internet to remember that the web is simply an application program.
Are you going to do a bunch of trouble with media work?
People, you know, it's important when we talk about the internet to remember that this is just one application program. You know, there are others. Like, there's with this application program, King. Like, King a computer at MIT. Or I can say TraceRoute. And I can look at all the computers between here and MIT and see how this network is constructed. I can watch the packets as they move from here to Roadrunner to that's because there's dark fiber that was laid between MediaOne, Roadrunner, and Harvard, and MediaOne and MIT. And so the very fastest way to get packets from here to MIT is to go through MediaOne. I'm talking about it. I thought we were only going to talk about it. So, the internet offers unique opportunities for the creation of something I call the data sphere. The internet gives us a way that we can finally connect together all the computers on the planet and allow any computer to access any database anywhere. It gives us a way that we can always be connected. And it gives us a way in which, every video camera, every one of those 300,000 video cameras in England, anybody can look at it any time. My nightmare is a very simple nightmare, and it's that the Code of Fair Information Practices won't apply in this future. I just keep going back to the same thing, because my legislative agenda for the year 2000 is passing the Code of Fair Information Practices.
Simpson, assume you're working for hard copy.
And creation
and our deadline is 5:30. You've got to help shape the news so the consumers know what's going on. So it can't be a Code of Fair Information Practices not enacted.
Well, it is. Is that we're going to be in a world where there are pervasive databases that track everything we do. We are going to be in that world, whether we want to be there or not. That world is being built. And it's largely being built without any public discussion whatsoever. My fear is that we're not going to have access to our data in other people's computers. We're not going to have the right to see if our information is correct or not. We're not going to have the right to demand that they remove false information. And these are very, very basic rights. They should be human rights. The UN says, the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights says that they're human rights. But they're not rights in the United States right now. So if I want, I can go to a website called anybirthday.com. Let me see if this is working today.
MiniBirthday.com. And, you know, fast countries pick up million birthdays online. Today's February 14th, here's the people who have birthdays today. And let's search the birthday database. And let's search for the name Jonathan Zittrain.
Yeah, you're supposed to know.
R-A-I. Oh, yeah. Is that what you're supposed to know? Yeah. And, you know, I don't know if it's a good guess with that. Now, the last time I tried this, I should say, we're, but, you know, it's a database.
No,
but I don't know what the home said. Oh, the function said. I guess I don't. You know,
I'm near the judge who remembers my birthday, but it doesn't.
Why is that so wrong?
Hey,
well,
okay, you, unless your mother's maiden name, and we can do a lot.
There is one
of
privacy issue with respect to the argument you made regarding to environmental issues?
Yes.
And I want to know exactly if you could flush that out a little bit more, because it seems to me that environmental issues are things that you don't do something and you can hurt other people if you're not careful. So is it privacy something you can hurt yourself?
Let's look at it deep. What's happening with environmental issues is that the actions by bad actors can have great consequences. And they can have great consequences to innocents, people who just happen to be members of the society. What's happening with what's happening with information, I believe, and Mark Rosenberg, please, he's letting me turn me on to the analogy, is that bad actors, people who are releasing personal information, can have great impacts on people who are innocent bystanders. I can be a bad actor. I can bring up a website that reveals name, social security number, others make a name of anybody you type in. And a company called LexisNexis did this. They charge like $5.95 a search. It was called T-Track. And then, through no fault of your own, somebody can look you up and do identity fraud. They're impacting your life. And under U.S. law, you have no legal recourse against the people because you're not extending credit. Chase Manhattan Bank has recourse if they use your name to commit fraud. But Chase Manhattan Bank has better things to do than to follow up. And that's why we have $1 billion of credit card fraud every year, 300,000 cases of identity fraud, identity fraud last year. The people who put the pervasive video cameras up, there are video cameras in downtown Boston now, they're being used for traffic. And there's the metro, there's the T-Pass system. And I don't know what's being used with the database of every time somebody goes through the data to the tolls. But we're changing the nature of our society. We're changing the idea, the default used to be when you were in public, that you knew that your actions, even though they could be monitored, probably weren't. You knew that there probably wasn't a police officer walking behind you, photographing you, and writing down everything you said. Legally, they could do that, right? Legally, somebody could hire a private investigator. As long as you were in public, anything you say was fair game, except in one of the few cases. And now that's not the default anymore. Now the default is that anything that can be recorded might be recorded. It's changing the character of our society. I think it's making people less interested in participating in politics. People are scared out of participating in grassroots politics now, for fear that something they like attack the big corporation that wants to put up the wall, that they might be targeted by the corporation's investigators. They might dig up something on this person. It's easier just not to participate. So I think it's very negative if you're interested in democracy. I think democracy and privacy are things that go together, and the loss of privacy destroys democracy. And yeah, that's okay for some people, but I think we should have a public discussion on it first.
Okay, well,
there's a school of thought that would say that it's good if you can be able to track certain things that people say or a certain message they're transmitting, because these are people who can be threats to democracy. I had worked at a firm, private sector, before I came here, in a situation where someone was passing around a racist email, and because the firm had the opportunity to get a go-through server and track people's email, and they just programmed it to pick up, you know, key colorful words, and so they were able to apply this person, and they had fired him, and set a standard throughout the whole, you know, firm, that people just weren't too loose with what, you know, their modes of communication. Some people said that that's a good thing because it can help create a, you know, sort of standard that people are not going to transgress, and also be dealt with. So,
no, I think this is an excellent example, and this is one of the reasons why businesses typically have different standards of protection for personal per email than non-businesses. There's a different expectation, and if you're doing things like that at work, you should expect to be found out. I don't think we have a right to anonymous email within corporate email systems. I don't think we should. Likewise, if we're going to be tracking people to release personal information, I'm all for it. I want to watermark all medical records that are printed out on demand by the doctor.
so that if somebody in the hospital faxes those records to a newspaper, you can look at the watermark and see who actually did the print. I think that that's why it's important to have discussions. That's why it's important to have this stuff covered by regulation. That's why it's important to have a regulatory body that's coming up with implementations of broad principles being put down by Congress. Because there are a lot of gray areas, and there does need to be a lot of public discussion. But we need to have that discussion. Right now, we're not having that discussion.
Well, let me accept that. Let me offer an alternative use of monitoring that was extremely successful. And that is the pharmaceutical companies did a great job of making sure that every one of their employees called the representative in their house in the Senate when the Clinton Health Reform Bill was being presented. They did a great job of tracking their employees' communication. And if you had not called the representative, they said, hey, look, you know, we want you to know that we noticed that you didn't call your representative. You know, this could really hurt your job. This bill is against your best interest. So it's not necessarily true that you never expect to be completely monitored for. And it depends on the, I'd say, a threshold of resources. If I brought a piece of paper in and I used my pencil at work to write a letter to my friend, we not only have our desk at work, we also sometimes have people who have to watch.
Yeah.
And I don't think that should
And the workplace has rules as to when you're allowed to open the locker room and you're not allowed to open the locker room. And you have that locker room because that's an area of higher privacy expectations. And one of the reasons I chose to spend 10 years working out of my house instead of working for large corporations is because I had a higher standard of privacy in my house. I had such a high standard of privacy in my house, I completely forgot about workplace monitoring when I wrote the book database edition. There's just no chapter on the monitored workplace. This is a great example for that chapter. Is that giving a record?
Tony?
Yeah, I'm
speaking.
Yes. You had sort of rejected the voluntary trustee model for privacy policy. And industry is not going to like government micromanaging how their policies are made.
Well, they say they do like government micromanaging as long as it's policies that protect industry. Well, they really want government micromanaging copyrights.
But what about sort of a third model, which is how we regulate the securities industry, where we have sub-regulatory organizations and the government just steps in when they're not functioning the way they should be?
That's a really interesting model, but those regulatory organizations, like the SEC is a public, but
most of the regulations done by the exchange.
If I choose to sell stocks on the internet to the first 100,000 people who give me stocks, that's covered by the exchange or by the SEC? By the SEC, we have more than a certain number. You offer to the public, or when you have more than a certain number of shareholders, you're a publicly traded corporation covered by all the rules and regulations.
I don't think thank you guys for coming. It really is 5:30, and I think we might want to speak.
Just a second, that would be, Sundas has a more reliable home than that of the Kennedy School servers. This is the authoritative source now, cyber.law.harvard.edu/SCP-307. And now you don't need anything. Well, you do have to have your cookies for not there's the syllabus, and you'll see that for Wednesday, there are readings. And that includes some readings out of Larry's book.
Which you made them by Larry.
Get it. Now, Mark Rothberg has written a blistering critique of Larry's chapter on privacy. I've been treated to it, and it was back. I'm trying to get Mark to publish it. If I get him to agree in the near future, I'll let you know how to get it. Anyway, there are three readings, and you'll see the FTC report is just parts 1 and 5, so it's not a whole lot of reading for us.
And when you are looking at optional readings, you should click on ICC's, because that's just one of those sites that tells you what they can see about you. I don't know if it's the one, I've been to PGP.
He used to have one that was completely bad. Okay, maybe I'll fix it.
Anonymizer has it too.
Detail.
Anonymizer has it.
In the same way, we're paying all the information about you. You should have received an email, actually two emails over the weekend. One was sort of updating the meeting with this site, the second email, the latest project list. If you did not get an email, please let me know so we can put you on the list.
I'm going to go to the